guys, welcome to a new episode of the Wits Mumbai podcast show. I am Aksa Bindiwala and I will be your host for today's episode. The Women in Data Science Initiative, abbreviated as WITS, aims to inspire and educate data scientists worldwide, regardless of gender, and to support women in the field of technology. WITS Mumbai is an independent event organized by WITS ambassadors to coincide with the annual Global Women in Data Science Conference held at Stanford University. You can find more information about WITS Mumbai on our website. Our WITS Mumbai podcast series will feature local data scientists talking about their work, their journey, and lessons learned along the way. So let's get started. Joining me in today's episode is Ritu David, who is the founder of The Data Duck, a product design and development firm. Ritu uses data insights and trends to design products that perform phenomenally. She has a diverse global experience and is highly motivated to bring about a change using data science. Hi, Ritu. Thanks so much for joining us today. Would you please give us a short introduction about yourself?
Yeah, hi, Akta. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here. I've spoken at a couple of your events and mixed with your community, and I'm always very inspired by every one of you. I think you covered my intro, and I feel like the listeners would like to know something about you as well.
Okay. So I'm currently working as a software engineer at JP Morgan Chase. I did my computer engineering from DD Sangvi College 2 years back, and just learning and growing in this data science community on the weekends.
That's great. It's lovely to see that you're following your passion. And you have the energy to do so on the weekend. Hats off to you.
Thank you so much. And thanks for being here today. So how did you begin your journey in the field of technology?
It actually started when I was at uni in Australia, university in Australia. I was studying actuarial science, and the software that we were using at the time, the interface was really clunky. And for me to run any queries or any regressions, we were working with smaller data sets then. This is in the early 2000s. I just found it exhausting. So I built my own interface to speak to the software. I think everything that I do is born out of some level of laziness, So I just didn't want to spend so long trying to figure out a software. So I tried to make it easier for myself. And that's where my journey in technology started, quite accidentally.
Wow, that's really good to know. So I guess my next question would cover up this, like, your education background has helped you shape as a data scientist.
Absolutely. Initially, actuaries were the people that worked with data, outside of the hardcore computer science world. We were tasked with looking at data sets across industries. I have classmates of mine who've gone on to work at Sony Pictures to understand to figure out the formula, if you may, for a blockbuster, what makes something a movie tick, what makes a movie a hit. So there's data being used to generate so-called creative expressions as well. And we just don't know it, or maybe it makes it seem less romantic, a movie that you loved was actually steeped in database decision-making.
Yes. So as you traversed through your journey, did you find some mentor who helped you and in your development?
Absolutely. I was very, very lucky to get a job straight out of university I think I had my final exam, and then I had a day to chill. And the next day I started a job at a policing advisory firm. It's like a policing consulting firm. And my mentor and boss there was Matthew Richman. I'm still very much in touch with him. He helped me see the community in a completely different way. You know, Matthew is truly a public servant in its purest form, and he seeks to serve the communities that he can. We had the Australian bushfires in 2008, and they were horrific. They were absolutely horrific. They ripped apart vast amounts of land and shook our communities, several deaths. So we were trying to use, at that point, people would use the phone to call a fire brigade, but all the lines, the cables had been burnt. So people were using mobile phones, and the call centers were inundated with too many calls. So by the time fire brigades or police emergency services reached where they needed to, it was too late. Either that or too many ambulances and fire brigades reached one place, leaving other places under service. So what we started to do was use crowdsourced data through Twitter. So if there was a very significant burn that was in the vicinity of the house, there was one category that the public could tweet, like say one. And if it were, they could see embers far in their vicinity, but there no actual fire, then they would say two. And this sort of helped us categorize emergency responses and send resources where we could have the highest impact. And I know that in an emergency, you always want to send as many, like it's always tough to make decisions because it's about life and death. But decisions have to be made, and they're really, really tough to make. And I think data helped us save the most number of homes, the most number of lives. So Matthew really changed the way I looked at data, because when you study actuarial science, at least back in the day, we were only looking at things like investment banking and shares, and it was very money focused, and I don't think my heart was in it. But yeah, Matthew just helped me see how much we can change the world using the skills that that we're lucky to build during our studies.
Wow, like that's a really nice experience you had with Matthew, and an amazing mentor to start off your journey. And yeah. So like when you were working in this project, were you and Matthew working on it alone, or it was a big team? Like how
it
did
was
you
a
manage?
Huge
like,
team.
Okay.
Like, yeah, it was a huge team, Exa. It was huge. It was just, you know, it was one of those things where, and I think we're seeing this now, you know, at the worst times, you have some of the greatest innovations, right. You know, so everything was so stretched and the traditional models of response were breaking down. And that's when like a little 20-year-old girl was like, hey, you know, I think we can use Twitter. So yeah, it was ages ago. But Twitter, I never thought ever that, you know, Twitter would help save lives, but it is the easiest way that we could, without any investment, you know, respond. So, yeah, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah, especially because so many people are active on social media. Lots of good can be done using the data which is put up there.
Of course, of course. I think it's a double-edged sword, you know. Yesterday I was speaking at the Global Peace Conference about this, and a lot of people were quite anti-technology. And I think, you know, you can't be for or anti-technology because it's there, you know. Yeah. We need to have positive conversations as to how we can use it for positive impacts. And there's always going to be nefarious elements who will use it for negative. And then apart from nefarious elements, you know I use technology for so-called, you know, less than optimal things. I binge watch on Netflix. I, you know, order pizza when I should be probably eating healthier. But it's not that technology is making me do this. All of this always existed in my life before. It's just that now technology has made it easier. Technology has made it just as easy to get organic vegetables to my house as well. But I just make that choice. So I think technology is here to stay, and it's the intended or unintended negatives that we need to learn how to deal with as a society. Yeah.
Absolutely, I agree. So it depends on the person, like if you're using it for something positive or negative. So it's not really related to technology, but how we are using it.
Exactly. And you know, there was so much conversation yesterday about fake news. And, you know, and surely technology has given us the ability to be content creators. But it's also given us a responsibility on how we spread content. So if we just forward things without checking facts, without seeing whether multiple sources have reported the same thing, then, you know, we're not doing our duty as creators of content and disseminators of content. Before, content was disseminated from news agencies. Content was created by journalists who, you know, worked to a certain ethics and standards, and they were let go out. They were, you know, chucked outside the journalistic profession if they broke those ethics, you know. Now we are all those people. And as much as it's beautiful that you and I can have this podcast and people can listen, and it's democratizing voices and everything, it's also giving us a responsibility that I don't think any of us really take too seriously, because we're not talking about it as a society. But I would hope that all of us, when we receive data, just like we do in our jobs, when we receive data during our downtimes, we check it and we verify it before we spread it any further.
Right, absolutely agree with you. Like with knowledge comes power, but also a responsibility to handle it with like correctly and not let it get out of hand, the situation. So yes, we need like data education so that the youngsters can understand, you know, how and what impact can their data have, the positive impact as well as the negative impact, so that they can correctly make decisions going forward. Like even the smallest decision about posting something on social media can have a huge impact. So yeah.
Exactly. And I don't know when you're much younger than me, so I don't know whether ethics was still part of your curriculum at school, but I wish that ethics would come back, and that, you know, ethics in technology and ethics in social media was part of something that, you know, at least we're educated in, and then we can make a decision. You know, I was educated in how to eat well. I'm making a decision to order pizza. You know what I mean? Yes. But at least the knowledge is there. So I think it would be good if we could all have the knowledge and then make decisions with that.
Yes, absolutely. So what tips would you give to people who are interested in data science, and like how do you think people should go about exploring it further? Since there are so many online resources, it's easy to get lost as a newbie. So how would you recommend
absolutely,
going further?
Absolutely. You know, one of the people, like there is a, I love the fact that there's so much interest in data science now, because apart from it being a very lucrative career, it's also and something that's just going to keep growing in scope. It's also something that's so much fun. I mean, if you can make sense of something that is nonsensical or just absurd, then it is a superpower. So I love solving little puzzles with data, and I just want the world to see how fun it can be. It's just, you know, I feel the tools that we use to play with data and get insights are so cumbersome. So it's not that data science is something that is difficult to do. It is the tools. Like, people are nervous about using software. People are nervous about learning how to code. And the younger generations, it's part of school curriculum, and they know that they need to code in order to even do a biochem degree, even to do medicine today. You know, at least you need to learn statistical software off some level, you know. But I wish that we would be more inclusive in how people can enter the data science field and understand that there's so many jobs in data science. You can be the person that asks questions of the data and someone else goes and finds you the answer. Often I find that there's a lot of people to find answers, but they're not enough people asking the right questions of the data set. So I think that there is space for everyone in data science, and it's just like learning a new language. You know, we've romanticized learning French and Spanish, but somehow, you know, learning Python or seems to be a bit scary for people. And I can understand, but there's so many apps that make it very easy to play around with. Like, I know that I installed Grasshopper on my dad's phone, and you know, he's 82, so if he can solve a few functions on Grasshopper, then I'm sure that younger, more digitally native people can learn how to code and just, you know, start small. Like, start with a small data set, and if you want to jump into big data, then know that you need to take a course in order to know how to work with it. Yeah.
So what are some of the resources that you would recommend?
You know, I feel that the first resource is the hardest one. And it's something that comes from within, which is self-reflection and understanding your purpose. And this sounds very spiritual, but I think it's incredibly linked with what you need to do, because to go the distance and not just to finish a course, but like, I think there was, I read on in an academic paper that about some staggering 96% of people who start online courses don't finish them, you know? So it's not just about finding the right course for you. I think that's that finding the course that you want to do. I think you need to find the right course for you. And I think that's the tough part, because if you find what's right for you that sits within your purpose, you'll do it. This morning I was speaking to a girlfriend who has been working in HR for years, and she's recently started working for HR in a firm that's, you know, doing a lot of R&D into cancer trials and cancer treatments. And she's finally found her purpose. And, you know, now work doesn't seem like work to her. So I feel the same way. Like, if you want to join data science, there's so many spaces that you can join it in, and you need to find out what you're passionate about. Everything today, town planning, pharmaceuticals, be it, there's someone that we're working with at the moment that's the Red Dot Foundation. They're looking to reduce the amount of gender-based sexual violence, and they're using data sets to solve this problem. So whatever it is that you're passionate about, you can use data science in that space. I've met someone who uses data science for sport. They code, they sit and they effectively tag every player's actions and then see how likely they are to get injured, and then start to talk to that player about preventative healthcare and things like that. So if you're passionate about cricket, you can become a data scientist who just watches cricket all day and works on cricket-based data sets. So find your passion, and then data science is a path to your passion, I feel. Like, if you're passionate about finance and understanding investments and stuff, then you're using data science to do that. You know, it's a journey. It's not a destination.
Wow, like, that's a really great way to put it. And I think you're absolutely correct. Like, for every industry, be it fashion or like you said, finance, you can find your passion and accordingly, you know, use data science to make an impact over there, to help solve problems and make people's life easier. So yes, amazing. Data science is an amazing field with endless opportunities.
Absolutely. So, I just, especially in today's world, sorry to cut you short, but I feel like, you know, our democracy survives when knowledge is given to all, and data science is something that can enable us to get less skewed knowledge and news out to the world. When you start to have facts, right. I think that's very strong, and it's a pillar of democracy.
Yes. So I watched your TEDx talk, Flesh, Bones and Data. Your take on modern human beings composed of flesh, bones and data was pretty interesting. In the video, you mentioned that in 2018, you spent around 250 days traveling through rural India. So, what were your key takeaways from that experience?
I think that experience really showed me the binary world in which we live. I mean, you and I are flesh, bones and data. What we're talking about now will end up being digitized and being accessible for everyone. Right. And there are other people who are off the digital grid. And that I can't stress enough how much of a humanitarian crisis that is. The people who are off the digital grid, we never hear their voices. They never get to vote on things in the sense that, you know, you and I can put out our voices, one, but two, we can also, through the power of our pockets, vote on what happens around us, you know. If we want a data science course, we get to Google, go into Google and type data science course. And then people who provide education will understand that, oh, in Bombay, in this area, there's a big demand for data science courses. And that can be easily accessed through Google search data. And that's us voting for the reality that we want. There are people who are off grid, and not only do they not get a say in the world that's being built around them and we don't hear their stories, but they actually can't tap into the digital economy, which is what's driving a lot of efficiency and effectiveness around the world. So we're saying that digitization has completely changed healthcare, completely changed the way logistics is done, etc. But they're not really in that value chain at all. So as you get less and less digital, the less you are part of the value chain, and therefore the less of the end price that the consumer is paying, that you can command less of that. So when I went to rural India, I was astonished that if I'm paying 100 rupees for a kilo of garlic, for example, in Bombay, they're getting less than 1 rupee. So it horrified me. And as I looked through the value chain, it's not like someone was taking super profits along the way. People were taking a lot of risk and they were being compensated for those risks. So it was one of those questions as to that really hit home as to, if no one's making super profits, then how do we get more to the farmer? Because there's someone else along the value chain who's being squeezed out in order for the farmer to get more, you know? Or can we create a system where everyone gets more without the prices that the consumer's paying increasing? Because that's a big part of having an equitable society, to have, prices that for essential goods like vegetables that are accessible to all. So it's a very complex chain. And I realize that farmers really need to understand the forces that create the demand and supply forces. They need to be able to participate in deciding, using that data, what they want to do. And not a lot of people say, oh, farmers just want to go the old way. They want to go the old way because the data that they have right now are the stories that their grandparents told them. The data they have now are the stories that their parents told them. They don't have access to anything else.
Right. So after this, you started an initiative, Rural India Solutions. Can you tell us something about that?
Sure. So Rural India Solutions was basically attempting to create a farm-to-fork solution where more of the price went to the farmer. And I started with this this vision that I would move to India and do something that has a high impact. And I tried very hard, but as I said, there's no one in the value chain that I saw was making super profits. So my ability to so-called, like what I thought my impact would be a lot higher than it ended up being. So I tried very hard, and I worked with 15,000 farmers in Punjab with a team of above 50 people. But sadly, at the end of last year, our company was not, was in the red every month, and I just couldn't sustain it anymore. I do have a lot of learnings from that time, and I'm still in touch with my team and the farmers in some way. And I hope that over time I can revisit it as I learn more about the way the country functions, the way agricultural supply chains work, and also the way agri-tech is evolving.
Yes. So in the future, hopefully, like, you can go back and start it again after you have found enough knowledge about it, like how you can help them, and probably
and also
till that time
you might also like you to help me and not do this alone.
Yes, absolutely. So maybe by that time, slowly and steadily, even the farmers will start becoming flesh, bones, and data. Thanks to Jio.
Absolutely, it's been a revolution, and now it's available, and we just need to make interfaces that are more inclusive for people who haven't had access to apps before, or don't are a bit worried about what they button they might need to press. So inclusive interfaces is something that we're working on at the moment.
Yes. So could you share some light on your company, Data Duck?
Absolutely. We are headquartered in Mumbai. We moved all our regional and international offices into Mumbai a few days before Mumbai went into complete lockdown. And it's been an amazing journey. At the moment, as I said, we're looking at inclusive interfaces for senior citizens. We are working with the Red Dot Foundation on citizen-led solutions for sexual violence, crowdsourced data. We're also looking at working with governments, Indian and Australian governments, to see how we can improve education outcomes for students that go to Australia from India. So we're doing a lot of very exciting stuff in the spaces that sit within our value set. And I think one of the biggest joys of being where I am today is the ability to pick and choose projects that align with our values and our purpose. Initially, we would take, whatever would give us money to sustain and to grow. But I feel the last few years have given us the ability to be a well-known name and to be able to pick and choose the projects that we work on and we spend our energy on.
That's a really nice, like, I can say, journey that you have had, and this experience of being able to choose the projects you're working on and, you know, making an impact, positive impact on people's life using your technology. So that you're not only like doing good for yourself, but also for others. I think that would be a perfect like job. So
It's taken a while though. AXA, it's not been like that from the beginning. We did a lot of stuff that wasn't negative in the sense, but it just, you know, it just didn't sit. It didn't drive me to wake up and be like, oh yeah, let's go make that corporation more money. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't make me jump out of bed in the morning, but you have to do that, or maybe I had to do that. I don't know if others do, but I had to do that. in order to build a company of a particular size and to be, you know, sustainable and stable enough to then say no and choose. Yeah.
Yes. So you're doing a lot of stuff between DataDark, the Rural India Solutions, and managing the company. So how do you manage your time between all this and your personal life?
You know, I have a dog and I rarely refer to him as my dog. I refer to him as my son, which makes everyone very confused. But this is bizarre, but I'm going to talk about basic biology, okay? Every few hours, he needs to go for a pee. So I need to take him out. When I go for a walk with him every few hours, it just allows me to take a break and take a breather and rethink how I'm spending the next few hours before his next pee. So he has sort of allowed me to break away and have these, you know, 10 minutes in between to really rethink how I'm spending my time and whether I'm optimizing it for me and my family. So having him around has really helped me bring in more work-life balance. I also think moving to India has helped because I'm in family, you know. When I was in Australia, I was alone and not living with my parents. When I moved to India, I lived with my parents, and now I live with my husband and my mother-in-law. And so being around family in close proximity, it's difficult for me, especially as a woman, to just be working all the time. I have so many more responsibilities now, you know, being in a joint family. So I think that work-life balance sort of just automatically comes into it. I love the way families are structured here. And I'm not sure how it is for others, but for me, India has taught me to value the people around me and spend time with people around me more.
Yes, that's great. Having a dog, like, it releases your stress. That's what I've heard. Like, absolutely. I do not own a dog, but like, that's what I've heard. They are your best friend. And
best. Oh my God, yes. Like, I left, if I leave for even 15 minutes, you know, to just pop over and get something from the bhaji, from the vegetable vendor, I'll come back and he'll react like he hasn't seen me in a year. You know, he's so happy. And just that, it's so uplifting. I think it shows how much we as humans need to be loved and cared for, and how much we need to be appreciated. And there's no one that will appreciate you as much as a dog. Like, yeah.
So can you tell us about some of the current projects that you're working on?
Sure. So there's one of the things we've worked on in the last, I think we started early this year, and the product's launching on the 4th of July. I can't say for whom, but it's a really big name in the USA, and hence it's launching on 4th of July. And it's a reflective app. You know, it's an app that allows it's not a guided meditation. It's more like a guided reflection. And having access to this content of reflections has really pushed not just me, but my team to understand ourselves better during lockdown and COVID-19 times. So the app has come at such a beautiful time. I mean, the timing of the app couldn't be more beautiful. I don't think this time is beautiful, but you know, the timing has been wonderful for us. So we feel very blessed to have access to this content before. If we weren't working on it, we wouldn't have had access to this content. So that's something that we're working on at the moment. And I can't wait for the world to be able to hear it on the 4th of July. Yeah, I feel, I'll let you know what the app is on the 4th, and I'll ask you to download it and get your feedback. It would be really great to have that feedback loop. And, you know, I've noticed that we've done a couple of meditation apps before, and once you've done one meditation app, you sort of start being looked at for other projects. So yeah, although we're industry agnostic, we've started to be known for, you know, once you get one project, it sort of just follows on and you fall into industries. But now what we're doing is a project that we're working on, as I said, inclusive interfaces that works across industries. You know, we're looking at creating interfaces for elders to include them in our flesh, bone and data world. Elders are another group that are left out often, not just the rural population. So I'm very excited to be working on this project. It takes a lot of old school data collection that I'm enjoying, you know, working with elders to understand how they navigate what their user experience is like, what are their apprehensions before they do a transaction online, for example. How can we address those apprehensions, and how can we facilitate more participation by elders in our flesh, bones and data world?
Yeah, that's really great. Looking forward to your app. Like, please do share it with me and the community.
I shall, definitely. And I hope you guys enjoy the reflections as much as we have had. We've enjoyed them, yeah.
Yes. So what does the tech community look like through a woman's CEO's lens? Like, as there are some still, like, at this 21st century, 2020, there are still biases in the tech community with respect to women and the pay and, you know, just the way they are treated. There are still biases involved. So, like, what does it look like through a woman's CEO's lens?
So I would like to say initially my personal experience and then open it out a bit more. I think I know that we are underrepresented. I know that women don't have as much opportunity as men in tech, in anything really, but specifically in tech. But I've also, in the last few years, there's been a lot of push for diversity in tech. There's been a lot of push for diversity of entrepreneurs in tech, you know. And I have been able to ride that wave personally. Maybe I'm invited to things as a token, like they just need to tick that they have one woman on the panel or they have one woman speaker. So I think being the token diverse, the token for diversity has served me well personally. Having tokenism in diversity doesn't help us as a community. And so I'm very aware that while I am benefiting personally, it's a very transactional benefit. And I would rather like all women in tech, you know, a high tide raises all ships kind of thing. So I would much rather be part of being lifted through that high tide that lifts all ships than, you know, someone just coming and plucking me up. So I think I'd like to separate the two. I also feel that more and more, in India especially, I don't think there's that much of a gap in STEM as there is in the West. Our company has all our coders are women. Every single person in our dev team is female, and that's not by design. That's just maybe now the last couple of hirings we've been like, oh, you know, maybe we do want to continue to hire female, but initially it wasn't by design. It was by default. We just found the best person for the job, and the best person who fit in culturally, who aligned to our values. And it just so happened that they were women. We do have a lot of men in our company as well, just not in the dev team. So I think as we grow, more and more movements like WIDS, more and more movements like women in tech. There's a lot of movements, women who code. You know what we need? We need mentors. We need mentors who genuinely help, who genuinely help other women network. I've seen the way my husband and his friends talk, and it just comes very naturally to them to be like, oh, you work here? Oh, yeah, yeah, I know this other guy who works there. Okay, yeah, yeah, maybe you guys should talk. And that just comes really naturally to them. Whereas, you know, when I meet up with my girlfriends, we talk about feelings and family and kids and, you know, all these other things, which is very important. But we're not, maybe we're not brought up to be networkers in that sense. I don't know about the nature nurture thing. I'm not a biologist or a psychologist, so I can't comment. But somehow, yeah, like, you know, the correlation causation sort of thing of evolution. I don't know how, but I've noticed the very different ways in which we even hang out with our friends. So I would love it if I could pick up the phone and ask you how you are, and then immediately be like, you know, hey, there's an amazing woman I know who's looking for a job in software engineering in a bank. Can you just have a chat with her, you know, and you guys meet up maybe now virtually and eventually for a coffee or a drink and just talk it out. So I would love to see more friendships that are about helping each other, and yeah, I would love it if more people just reached out and said, hey, I need help with that, or hey, can you do this, or hey, how about I do this for you. I think we just need to be less nervous about asking for things, and just it's okay if you feel it's transactional. What's the worst? The other person will just say no.
Yes, so I think there's lots of fear, and you know, like, there'll be a judgments, like when you come out and say that I need help and if you could do that for me, and then, you know, sometimes people do not respond. So like, we need to change that, and like, that's what we're trying to do with forming a community of, you know, women technologists who will help and support each other. So yeah, so also, like, since lots of initiatives have been started by companies for increasing the women diversity in the companies, so I think because of that, the men do not respect the women. They feel that, you know, they have been brought in just for the diversity quota and not because of their skills. That's another problem that we need to address.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, like, has that happened in have you seen the situation somewhere?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I, not anymore, but when I used to go for tech conferences about, even so current as like 5 years ago, I would walk up to the registration table and they would take me to the media table. You know, and I would be like, I'm not media. And they're like, they just stare at my face. Like, are you a cleaner? Like, who are you? You know? So yeah, I think, the diversity thing is very tough, and I don't know enough about it as to how do we, make it more equitable? How do we have quotas and then not be looked at, as I said, the token diverse female, but, a lot of times it's about the work showing for itself. And I just feel that when, and I know I see this in my workplace, like if a guy has done something, just think of the alphabet, right? And if a guy, and I'm broad brushing and I'm stereotyping here, but I have enough data from my years of experience to say this for my experience, it's not a universal thing. But if a guy has written the letter A on a blackboard, he will be like, look at me, I know how to write the alphabet, I'm awesome, look at this, right? If a girl has written till J and then is like, oh, I don't know about the next letter, I'm not sure, she will erase it all and walk away and never say that she did it, you know? Yeah. And when it comes to to pushing for a promotion, women are always like, oh, you know, I'm going to have a child, so I need maternity leave. So maybe it's not a good year to ask for a raise. And I'm like, what do you mean it's not a good year to ask for a raise? Your skill set has increased. Your ROI to the company is increasing. You can definitely ask for a raise. You know, where I just feel like there's a lot of hesitation to ask. And I think a lot of that stems from our societal sort of makeup, where if a woman asks, it's bossy or bitchy, you know. And I think we just need to own those B words. If you want to be a boss bitch, be a boss bitch. I'm sorry to use this on this podcast. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to, but you can just beep it out. I feel like we just need to own the pronouns that have been used to put us down.
It's only after that we can actually start growing. Like, once we have accepted,
exactly.
Like, even if we like do not accept it, people are just going to judge us. So like, might as well accept it and then, you know,
yeah,
start growing.
Just say that, you know, a guy wouldn't be called bossy in this scenario. A guy would be called, would be seen as taking control.
Yes.
You want to see me as bossy? It's fine. We have a job to get done. It will get done, you know? And then I think it's really hard. It's really hard because there's not much empathy around and we don't have a community. But the more communities you build, like with, and that we can come back and say, you know, this is what I'm feeling. And just knowing that someone else is going through it and you're not the only crazo in the world having these emotions helps. It helps.
Yes. So like, many women technologists would like to start their own companies, but they do not know like how. So what tips would you give them?
Sure. I think, you know, one, a very simple way to start, or the way that I started at least, is to become a sole proprietor, in the sense that the skills that you are currently trading for a salary, you then trade for a contract and a payment to your company. What that means is you may be the sole employee of that company. It's fine. But at least you've started a company. You've got one project in your company's portfolio. You're still getting paid a salary. It's just a different way of structuring the conversations you have with people. And often if people feel that, you know, they need you enough, that project, or they need you to work on that project enough, you can have those conversations. And once you have one project, you can get a second project. You might have enough to hire someone else, and you don't need to go get funding, because I know that fundraising for women is quite challenging. You don't need funding. You can start small. You can start a business without getting funding, which may blow many people's minds, but I've never raised any funds. I don't intend to raise unless I feel that the product I need to build needs genuine funding that I can't provide. So I think if you're in, especially in the services space, data analytics, and you're not going out to build a product, it's a no-brainer for you to just start a company as a sole trader, and then build slow and steady. I know not all of us can take massive risks. You don't have to, but as long as you're, you know, growing a little every year, you'll eventually get to where you want to get to.
Okay, that's really great advice. I hope our listeners can benefit from that. So like, you have been through a lot of different experiences working in companies and then starting your own company. So what advice would you give to your younger self based on the lessons you have learned over the past few years?
Oh, you know, I used to spend so much time getting ready for work when I was younger. I don't know. I had in me, you know, I was in Australia, so I had in me a very stereotypical Caucasian look that I felt I needed to fit in order to be seen as professional. And I would spend, you know, an hour in the morning straightening my hair and doing my makeup and ironing my clothes that were, I felt, made me fit into the culture more. And I could have used that hour to just sleep, you know, and get more rest to fuel my body up for the day. So I know it seems superficial, but I think just I would wish that I had the courage to be myself, and the courage to know that it's my efforts that are being assessed, and not other random things like what's in my lunchbox and whether the curry is making the office smell, and you know, all these things that I felt very, very conscious about as a brown person in Australia, way back when there were not many brown people in tech in Australia, at least.
Okay. So like, what are the 5 things that concern you about the data science industry, and like, why? Are there some things like, you know?
There are a lot of things. May I just say what concerns me the most, yes, rather than 5?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Sure. Yes.
Okay. Thank you for reducing my homework. So I have one massive concern that is quite overarching, I feel. I feel that the data science community and the tech community is very insular. We tend to stay within ourselves, and it's not... and then there's a whole other community, which is people working on in government, people working on impact projects, people working in development, people working on social issues. And I feel that what concerns me is that they're not part of the data community, and that we're not inviting them to the table when we're having discussions. Just because someone doesn't understand data science doesn't mean we can't facilitate them to have conversations with us. I feel like we need to be on the same side of the table as people who shape the world, leaders of the world, whether it's social, you know, in society, leaders of society, leaders of commerce, leaders of government, political leaders. We need to meet with them, and we need to be on the same side of the table as them, because otherwise I don't know if we're adding the kind of value that we can add. We need to continuously have conversations with people outside of our industry, and understand how we can add value, because I know we can add immense value. It's just that, you know, it's taken so long for people to understand the power of data and the power of digital, but we're still a very separate, you know, they're like, okay, if we have funds, then we will fund this project with data. You know, we can't be a separate. We have to be a layer on which everything is built. So what concerns me about the data science community is that we don't have participation from the people who are truly shaping the world.
Yes, until and unless we have all perspectives into account, we cannot make a truly informed decision. So yes.
Yeah.
What are some of the strategies that you and your company used to stay afloat during this COVID-19 pandemic?
You know, it's been tough because working out of India, a lot of people, and I said, you know, we just moved, we moved to Bombay, and a lot of people were in temporary housing without internet connections because it was like 3 days, you know. So you move to a new city, you're in temporary accommodation, no gas, because you just thought, okay, for a week or two, I'll eat outside and I'll find a house. So it's been very, very tough for my team. And the resilience that my team has shown during this time is just beyond what I can comprehend. People have stayed in places. You know, there was a time when you couldn't order food in. Imagine not having gas or the ability to cook. It has blown me away how resilient people have been. It's also blown me away that no one has had scurvy, even though they were just eating like 2-minute noodles from a carton that you just pour boiling water into. So I have, I've just been astonished by how resilient people can be. Also, I'm a little bit concerned because a lot of my team stays in places where electricity isn't something that we can take for granted, and working from home is something that a truly privileged person in India can do. And it's opened my eyes to the whole flesh, bones and data thing that we were talking about earlier. It's people who are working for tech companies also like mine, who don't have access to solid internet at home, who don't have access to electricity at all times. And it's really challenging to be productive if you don't have electricity and work from home. So there are all these things that I'm understanding more and more about people's lives at home when they're outside of the office, and really trying to figure out how can we collectively improve each other's environments, and also ensure that everyone is feeling mentally strong. So I think this time has brought us all together. It's also made us problem solve on levels that I've never thought of before. We've had people saying, you know what, I've got, my sister's got a laptop, she's not using it, I'm going to send it to XYZ who's struggling with electricity because this laptop has a really long battery life. And I mean, there's been amazing kindness and a lack of, you know, barriers of assets. Like, it's almost like everything is a communal asset, and how can we optimize it? And it's really lovely to see.
Yes, like in these worst of times, the best of people is brought out, and the support that we have for each other is like truly amazing.
Exactly. I mean, there's a design team where one of my, there are two people on one project, and one of the designers on the project doesn't have electricity every day from about 10 to 3. So the other designer has, you know, this is peak working period for us. So the other designer has taken on two people's work during that time. So, and hasn't complained at all. It's been 3 months. So, you know, this is amazing.
Yes, absolutely. So what is your favorite life lesson quote? Can you share a story of how that has had relevance to your own life?
Sure. I have a dear friend of mine, Radhika Bapat, who's a life coach and a psychologist based out of Pune. She sent me a Rumi quote that I love, what you seek is seeking you. And I didn't understand this before, but I really genuinely believe it now. I've started to get a lot more spiritual as I get older. And I think this time, I've read the Gita, and this time I've been looking a lot at, you know, my family's spiritual history and understanding how, you know, we think what we think or hold what we hold valuable and all of that. So I really believe in vibrational energy, and what you give out, it's like The Secret, right? But maybe a little bit more Asian than that, in the sense that the energy you give out, every piece, gratitude, for example, has a particular frequency. And I think this can be found has its roots in quantum physics, in the sense that every emotion you feel, every thought has a frequency and a vibrational energy, and it attracts certain things. So what you seek is seeking you. So if you're seeking purpose, if you're seeking beauty, if you're seeking true selflessness, the universe will give you so much back. And I think that quote has started to click more and more in these last 3 months as I deep dive into my spiritual roots.
That's a really nice quote, and like, I'm sure like there are many other people who have connected with it. And so like, do you practice yoga?
You know, I'm so ashamed to say I don't. I've owned a yoga mat for the last 12 years, and I have not practiced yoga. In fact, one of the first things that I bought when I moved to India was a yoga mat, and I was so convinced that I was going to do yoga, because how can you not? And I also lived in Pune for quite a bit. That's where my parents live. And and I have, they're massive. I mean, Iyengar Yoga Institute was right next to my house and I never did it. So maybe it is time. I know it's time. But I find it a lot easier to go somewhere emotionally and intellectually than to go somewhere physically, if that makes sense. I think we all have different mobilities. Like my husband's very task-based, and if I tell him get on the mat and do this, 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 he'll do it. But he may not get there emotionally or spiritually. So I think we all have a little bit of inertia in our different selves. So hopefully my physical self, the inertia is lifted once you know I'm there emotionally and intellectually. Yes. And spiritually. Yeah.
So like yoga is also about like being at peace mentally. It's more about the mind. So once your mind is at peace, then your body will flow, like based on like what I've learned over the years and through some of the practice that I've been doing. So it's more like, you know, like your mind is at peace and then you can just do whatever. And it's not like you just have to do all these fancy asanas. Like your body will speak to you once you start, you know, practicing. So yeah, that's some of the experience that I've had.
You know, Aksa?
Yes.
You said, where should someone start in the data science world? I have a question. Where to start in the yoga world? Because it's like a million yoga courses and a million, yes, million types of yoga, and I just don't know where to start. So that's maybe something that you can do a podcast on.
So like I think most important is to be able to just, you know, be present in the moment. So that, and then you start doing these basic asanas. Like when I started off, I googled yoga for beginners, and you know, there were lots of videos and PDFs, so I just followed along. So after some time, like after some time after practicing those asanas, I started I stopped practicing those asanas, and I just did what my body felt like moving in some direction. And you know, like, it's just a self-discovering journey, I feel. So, and there's of course lots more to learn and grow for me. Like, I'm not some big yogic or something. Just small practices, I think they make a big difference. Yeah. I think we
diverged a little. That's beautiful. I'm glad that you found it. Well, that's fine. Maybe yoga and meditation is the original data science, you know. The clarity of thought, the way your whole body's data moves together. Maybe it's the original data science, who knows?
That's an amazing thought. So, like, are there any books that you read, have you read in the lockdown, or some of your favorite books that you could share with us?
Oh, yeah, sure. There's a book that, you know, I have, and I have read. Now, to practice what I've read from that book is a whole nother ball game, but it's Indistractable. I think it's TEDx Gateway. It's by Nir Eyal, who's the behavioral designer. He initially wrote Hooked, How to Create Products, Habit-Forming Products. And then he realized that he himself was so addicted to these digital products that people like me design, that he wanted a way to be present for his daughter. And so then he went into this whole realm of study as to how can we be indistractable. So that's a book that I've read in these last 3 months. And it's worked to some extent for me because I'm in such a controlled environment of the home, and there's only that many many distractions. Exactly. But in an office with the whole team and all of that, I think I will be pushed to the real test will be there, you know. So I think I'll have to get back to you when we return to what people are calling the new normal or whatever, and understand how indistractable I truly am in a setting where there are distractions everywhere.
Right. So, are we almost done with the session? Where can our readers connect with you on social media?
You know, I'm really bad on Twitter. I've realized that I only use Twitter to get angry, you know, at brands that have done something wrong by me. So my Twitter self is not my real self. I'm not this angry person, but I feel like brands only respond when you tweet. You know, if you've had like a bad experience with an airline and you put it on Twitter, suddenly your luggage is found, or something like that. But I feel on Instagram, I'm my real self, in all the realms, in my flesh, bone, data, soul, heart, everything. My handle is Ritu_David on Instagram, and I'd love for people to reach out there. I'm very responsive on Instagram.
Okay, thanks for sharing that with us. So with that, we come to the end of our session. It was a really great and informative session. Thank you so much, Ritu, for joining us today and sharing your amazing, insightful experience with us. I hope our listeners will benefit from this episode as much as I did.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for building a community for women like me in data science.
Thank you.